more and more, I'm starting to realize how much those like breaks for me, whether that's exercising, spending time with family, sometimes it's, you know, watching a TV show, listening to podcasts, you name it, help me just kind of detach and then come back. And all of a sudden, a lot of the noise is gone. Figuring out like, what is it that your soul, what is it that you are going to need as a human in order to manage and balance and grow on this journey? Because it's going to be incredibly hard. It's going to take way longer than you think. You're going to want to give up a lot of times. And so, you know, realizing that you're your own MVP, like you are your most valuable player. And so how can, you know, you prioritize sleep and the things that really matter, because it allows you to show up with kind of energy where like 7 hours of my best energy is better than 20 hours of me operating at 70%. That 30% difference there makes a huge, huge impact in my clarity of thought and my ability to prioritize and make the right decisions.
What's up, gang? You're listening to the Forcepreneur Podcast, and I'm your host, Ankit. On this show, I talk to founders of profitable Salesforce companies and try to get a sense of what it is to be an entrepreneur in Salesforce cosmos. How did it all start? And how was the journey until now? How do they make decisions, both in professional and personal life? Our goal here is to learn from their examples so that the rest of us can go on and build our own profitable Salesforce businesses. I'm really excited to interview my guest today because she has been creating a lot of waves in the last months. I'm making an exception to my 3 years rule, which is to only interview entrepreneurs with more than 3 years of experience, because I think she has a very inspiring story. So without any further ado, she is currently the CEO of Speckit, which she also co-founded. Hello, Melanie. How are you doing today?
Hi, doing great, Ankit. Thanks so much for inviting me and making the exception. We're 2.5 years in, so not quite.
Yeah, well, you were the chief of staff. That's close. And as I mentioned, so you have been creating a lot of waves recently. So the recent one was, tell us about it, where you have this new woman group or some mentor group that you just joined. So you and your co-founder?
Yeah, so we just raised from the Operator Collective. It's a VC fund that's based in San Francisco that was started by Malin Yen. And what's really unique about this fund is that her goal is to really bring more equality to the overall like funding landscape, right? Today, 2% of funding goes to women and other minorities in the VC space. And when you look at, you know, Forbes list of 100 of the world's most innovative leaders, there was one woman on that list and zero Black people, right? And so the reality is, in the broader funding ecosystem, there is a lack of opportunity for a lot of diverse founders. And so Malin's, you know, idea to solve that is, well, we need more investors that are women, and we need more investors that are diverse. And so she raised $50 million from operators, successful CEOs, CROs, COOs of, you know, the world's biggest companies, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Airbnbs, the Ubers, to then invest in the next generation of B2B enterprise software. So we consider ourselves really fortunate to just have brought them on both as an investor and a partner. And what I'm particularly excited about is Layla Seca from Salesforce. She was she really built and scaled the App Exchange over a 10-year period, joined Malin as her partner. And so Layla is going to be joining our board as an observer, and we've already learned so much from them. So really excited about that partnership and really what it means for the broader, you know, hopefully future leaders.
Congratulations. Right.
Thank you.
So let's continue from there. And I am all for female entrepreneurship, by the way. And I think there should be more female entrepreneurs. More power to you. So tell us, how did you come up with the idea of Speckit? And of course, Speckit is co-founded by two women. So how did you find your co-founder? And yeah, what does Speckit do? Take us through.
Yeah, absolutely. So Speckit was really born out of the frustrations that I felt and that my co-founder felt when we were working together at our last company. At our previous company, it was called Realty Shares. It was a real estate tech company. And as an organization, we'd invested in Salesforce a significant amount and had tried to make it work over a year-long period. But as is often the case, we didn't have a real executive sponsor behind it. We made a lot of poor decisions along the way in terms of building out the system. And so over a year in, no one was using it. Our sales teams in particular weren't using them. And what was important to realize there is that they came from traditional real estate backgrounds. So they'd been operating out of Outlook and spreadsheets their whole lives. And so for them, having to use Salesforce felt more like a hindrance than a benefit. And that's when I really started my quest for looking for, like, how do we solve this problem around training, adoption, change management, and enablement. And so I was looking initially to just document our Salesforce, right? I wanted to build out a data dictionary because our Salesforce was integrated to a ton of other systems. And what I quickly realized is that all existing documentation solutions that were really tied to Salesforce were really meant for, like, true admin and developers, right? They weren't meant to be a business-facing tool that I could invite our sales leader or marketing leader to easily come in and find the information. Yeah, so Speckit is a digital adoption and documentation solution. Specifically, it integrates with Salesforce, which allows you to pull in all of your fields and your processes and to kind of use that as a baseline for your documentation. But what makes us really unique is that we're really designed to be a solution that, as an employee, I can access any answer, any question that I have, whether that's on Salesforce, whether that's on how to do my job, whether that's on any other application, right when and where I need it. And so we have a number of extensions. We have a centralized place where all the documentation is stored.
Right. So how old is Speckit? How far are you in your journey? How many customers do you have? And most important question every entrepreneur, every startup guy asks, how did you find those first customers?
Yeah, so Speckit is 2.5 years old. We launched at Dreamforce in 2018 after building the product for 6 or 7 months. We had a soft launch at Midwest Dreaming as well. And so our first customers are actually born out of these community events. We met a few leads at Midwest Dreaming, and then we actually closed our first customers after Dreamforce. We were lucky enough. We got our first customer, our first three customers, as a result of a user group that we did in Dallas, August of 2018. So right before Dreamforce, that's when we met Nana Gregg over at JLL, and we ended up closing that deal in December. And that's also how we met some of our smaller, you know, first customers that had anywhere between 25 and 50 users.
So you would say that going to Dreaming events or going to the community events is beneficial for a startup. And I bet you were not a sponsor over there. You just went as visitors, or did you sponsor something?
So we actually did sponsor. We had a small booth. And the great thing is, as an entrepreneur, you know, you typically don't have a lot of money when you get started. And so for us, Dreaming events were a phenomenal way to get in front of a lot of customers, be able to do really significant product research, because at the end of the day, your idea you might think is good, but it doesn't really matter until you put it in front of customers. And
Absolutely. So
we were able to get a lot of real-time feedback, real-time reactions, real-time, you know, suggestions. And then on top of that, we were able to actually start building a pipeline of customers that were willing to try it out and to eventually pay for it.
Right. So I assume you guys bootstrapped it and then you kind of got the VC money. Or was this your just first funding that you got?
We raised actually last September a little over $2 million as well. So we didn't completely bootstrap it. Zari and I both invested a good chunk of money in it to get started. And then our prior CEO from our last company made an angel investment. And then we had some family and friends as well make some investments. So we started off with about $300,000 in cash, which seems like a lot. It really isn't when you're starting a business and you're seeding all the research and development costs. I mean, Zari and I didn't pay ourselves for a year and a half. I moved back to Colorado out of the Bay Area. I ended up living with my grandmother for a year and a half, for a little less than a year and a half. So there were definitely a lot of, you know, behind the scenes. Zari downgraded to a studio apartment. You know, she took her discovery calls from her bathroom because her husband was sleeping. There was a lot of choices we made along the way to try and get to this point.
That's a classic story of a founder. Well, that's what you have to do. You have to hustle. You have to do this. And it's important that you mentioned you invested your own money, because I think you need to have your skin in the game. And that's also good for the VCs, because they see that you're also invested in it. I mean, I know a bunch of founders here who just want to raise money. And I'm like, this is not how it works. You need to have a skin in the game. You know, you need to show to the investor that I'm serious about this. Otherwise, why would somebody give you even $100,000, you know, when he sees that you have not even put in $1,000?
So, and, you know, and I think a lot of companies think that they need to raise their seed round before building the product to be able to, you know, to front, you know, a year or 2 years of that initial product development process. But I'm actually really glad that we didn't, you know, that we tried to make it work with a very, very small amount of money, because it forced us to be ruthless with our time, ruthless with our decisions, ruthless with our spend. and, you know, what bets we were taking, and to really think twice. It wasn't just like, oh, let me just hire, you know, people without having an actual product to sell yet, right? So I sold our first, like, 35 deals myself, and I don't even come from a sales background, but I was like, I need to actually be on every single call, understand the buyer pain, understand what these admins are going through, understand what these, you know, IT leaders, understand what these learning leaders are going through, in order to, one, you know, give that feedback to our product team to build the best product, but B, really get to understand the messaging and our customer at its core.
Nice, nice. I think people are getting note of this, that, you know, when you are a CEO, it's not just about, oh, I'm the CEO, I sit in the office and I do the work. You need to be on the field, on the ground level, and exactly know what your product is doing.
Absolutely. Interesting.
So, yeah. So what's your customer acquisition model, and what are your plans? What's your revenue model like?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a traditional SaaS recurring revenue model where we have a per user license, and then we charge a nominal Salesforce integration fee as well. We have a classic freemium model as well. So we're completely free, up to 10 users, all functionality. There's absolutely no limits on what we offer there. And that's really great for either small companies that are growing. It's great for nonprofits that can't afford. And now, in terms of our customer acquisition, we're fortunate that a lot of it is inbound. And then we've just started doing some outbound as well. So proactively seeking out companies that might be a fit for Speckit.
Interesting.
And then we're also listed on the AppExchange.
Nice. So I also know that you do a bunch of writing on LinkedIn, which is very nice, which is also very profound. I mean, it's not just business, because I am huge on mindfulness and meditation and taking care of your health. And I really liked your article. I think I also told you that it was a really nice article. But I don't. That's not a part of Speckit. That's just you, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the last 2.5 years have been incredibly mentally challenging and rewarding, of course.
I bet.
And one of the biggest things that I kind of recognized early on is that, you know, I'm a younger entrepreneur. I've got less experience than some of my peers. And, you know, I had a lot of, I guess, limiting beliefs around my ability to build this company and my ability to move forward. And so for me, I quickly realized that I needed to really invest in that personal growth side of things, and really learn to, you know, manage the psychological side of things, you know, manage my expectations, and really focus on the practices, whether that's mindfulness, whether that's exercising, whether that's finding the right work-life balance to actually be able to show up at my best every day for our team, for our customers, and for investors.
I think that's really important, because some of the people really undermine that. And, you know, this Facebook-y hustle thing that's online, which is you just work, 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 work. I think that's not possible. Nobody can be so productive. It's important to take breaks. It is important to take back sometimes, so that then you can view the bigger picture. And sometimes you come back and you're like, geez, what was I doing? You know,
on that note, I always laugh because some of my best ideas have popped into my head. I mean, truthfully, out of nowhere, like as I'm exiting a hot yoga class, I'm like, wait, where did that come from? You know, which is, I can't explain how they pop into my head, but that's where they come from. Like, actually, we did a diversity at Dreamforce scholarship last year to basically pay it forward to another business, because we'd had the chance to launch at Dreamforce again because we had that angel funding. For us, it was phenomenal in getting us on the map. And I was like, man, like, I wish, you know, we could pay it forward to another business. So I reached out to Blakely, the CEO of TaskGray, to Andrea, and to Kelly at Cloud Giants, and within 3 phone calls, raised $30,000 to be able to sponsor a scholarship for a new diverse business to launch at Dreamforce. And that idea, you know, came from, I guess I'd been talking about just diversity earlier that day, went to yoga, and that night I'm like, wait, Dreamforce is in 2 months. Like, what can we do to bring diversity to the, nice, you know, for nice. Dreamforce and to the vendors? And so it's, to me, I've always, more and more, I'm starting to realize how much those, like, breaks for me, whether that's exercising, spending time with family, sometimes it's, you know, watching a TV show, listening to podcasts, you name it, help me just kind of detach and then come back. And all of a sudden, a lot of the noise is gone.
So I will first of all put an applause for what you did at Dreamforce. I think that's really commendable. Secondly, how's the growth of Speckit been like? What's your revenue? Are you guys in green? I mean, you raised some capital, which is, again, awesome. So has it been fruitful until now?
Yeah, it's been really good. I mean, compared to our first year, which obviously was 2018, you know, we over 7x'd our growth last year, which, you know, if you talk to most founders, the goal is always, you know, triple, double, in order to reach that unicorn status. So that's kind of the numbers out there. And this year we're hoping to see similar growth rates as well. But we're seeing more and more companies really thinking about, like, okay, we can't just be investing millions and millions of dollars into, you know, all these different tools and all these different applications on top of Salesforce. We need to invest a certain percent of that to ensure that people are actually making use of that tool so that we're getting the business results we're looking to achieve. And so we're seeing an increase just volume of organic demand just as companies and leaders start shifting their perspective around the importance of driving adoption.
Nice. So documentation and Salesforce documentation and learning, like, this space is getting hot now. I mean, you have a lot of competition. So you have Element, which is like a little older than you. Then you have the Audasava. How are you placing yourself? I mean, of course, you're doing your own thing, but how are you dealing? Because the space is getting hot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the solutions are phenomenal solutions, but again, they're really driven to be owned by an admin, owned by the business systems team. They're really deep on the Salesforce side. We're a broader solution in the sense that most of our owners are the sales managers. It's your power users. It's the learners, the learning managers, because we're not just a Salesforce solution. We really are a cross-application solution. And the idea is that when I'm in LinkedIn and I'm prospecting, I need to know, you know, how to position our product vis-a-vis that particular prospect. How can I find the knowledge I need to do my job there? But that information is also helpful to me when I'm in Salesforce and I'm reviewing my opportunity and I'm looking to understand, like, okay, wait, I've got a big call with a CTO. What are some of the key questions that I might want to ask to get the answers that I need? And so we're all about that broader enablement solution. And so to me, being tied and strategically aligned to the Salesforce ecosystem and using our integration and everything to facilitate as much of that documentation as possible is really key to our differentiation. But I think at the end of the day, we sell to completely different audiences. We are really building it from the learner's point of view. How, as a human, as an employee, do I want to learn? Do I want to be told what to do? Do I want to be able to easily find answers? And so you'll see that a lot of our functionality is designed really to be an end user tool that, you know, ideally is something that they want to use every day to be enabled.
Nice. I think that's a very good value proposition that you're building, and it's a very smart niche. Hats off to you for that.
Yeah.
Right. So nice. We talked a lot about Speckit and technology. Let's move to the entrepreneurial side. So I'm really curious because I also have a co-founder, and we met at a Salesforce meetup. I organized the Berlin Developer User Group, and this is how we met. So, but we had never worked before, and somehow it just fits. It's like a German machinery. We both are on a very good level. It's as good as I have a second relationship with him. Like, I have one girlfriend, and then we just finish each other's sentences. It's bizarre. How did it all come up? Because this is also one of the challenges that people face, finding a co-founder. And why a co-founder? Okay. Why didn't you go yourself?
Yeah, no, I mean, I truthfully cannot imagine having done this by on my own. I don't think I would. I think I would have thrown back a number of times by now. Now, Zari's by far one of the most special people in my life, both as a co-founder, but also as a friend, you know, and like you said, it's challenging because it really is like that relationship, like you develop such deep trust. I mean, she knows my bank accounts, right? Like, it's just, you know, I mean, it's just wild. But truthfully, like, I think we got really lucky in the sense that we used to work at the same company, but her and I weren't on the same team. I just knew her as she ran the show on the product side. And I basically was in charge of all of our operations. And because of my role, I was in a few product meetings. So I got to kind of see her the way that she presents. And she's so meticulous and detail oriented and really brilliant. And, you know, we worked at a company that had a lot of challenges. And so when we'd walk out of those rooms, her and I would kind of talk and we'd go to the coffee, you know, go get water. But it was really just in like those hallway conversations that I got to see that, like, vision-wise and value-wise, we were really connected. And so we hadn't worked closely together. She didn't actually know what I was like in a day-to-day, but we said, like, hey, let's crawl, walk, run here. Let's date before we get married. And so we started, you know, doing a little bit of research on the project together. We had dinner once or twice together to talk about it more. And then, you know, when she was like, this is something that I can get behind, we actually sat down and had a really vulnerable conversation. We signed what's called a founder's agreement. What's funny to go look back at is like how we used to describe the product and the words that we use. It's really funny, but it also kind of forces you to outline, like, here's the parts of the businesses that you're going to be responsible. Here's who's going to make the ultimate decisions. Here's how we're going to split up equity, you know, and have a lot of those tough conversations up front and just see, how do we react to those? Are we able to have you know, are we argumentative? Are we able to work through things? And so, you know, through those number of conversations, it helped us kind of realize like how we face uncomfortable, challenging situations in the process. And, you know, I really think that at the end of the day, like we hold the same values when it comes to, you know, we are so driven and really on a mission to help make it easier for employees to be successful and learn in the workplace. And we're so connected to that mission, but we're also really connected to the fact that, you know, Speckit is a huge, huge part of our lives, but it's not the only part of our lives, right? She's married. Perfect. Family is a huge, you know, piece of value. Making work-life balance. I was like, Saturdays, I cannot work. Like, I was like, I need Saturdays to just be my time to remind myself that I'm, you know, a normal person. And so we established some of those guidelines early on. And the great thing is we've been able to maintain those, which has been really, really great.
Should also interview Sari later.
Yeah.
Right. So this is your first venture. How has the ride been so far? Like, don't, not the business part, for personally for you, how has the ride been? How's the journey been meeting your co-founder? How many people do you have now? Hiring people.
So it's 28 of us right now.
Okay. That's pretty decent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how has the ride been so far?
You know, overall it's been really good. You know, I think there's been so many rewarding, incredible experience, so many, you know, connections that we've made over the last 2 years, so many great customers that we brought on. I've had a lot of support from my friends and my family. But, you know, in the earlier stages, it was hard. I mean, luckily, you know, Zara and I were very fortunate that having worked at like a high growth VC backed startup, I mean, real cheers at $60 million in backing and like really seeing it from like 15 employees to 150, like we kind of had seen a lot of the challenges come with like high growth and scale and hiring a million people and just like, you know, things getting a little bit defunct. And so I'd already worked in a very high stress environment. And prior to that, I'd worked at another startup. And so, you know, I think I luckily had had a little bit of practice in the whole managing stress where everything feels like it's the end of the world. And you're like, wait, I'm living in my little bubble here. There's a lot bigger issues happening out there. But I think for me, the biggest challenge has been, you know, early on, about a week ago, I was still alone in Denver. I didn't have a sales team. I didn't have a marketing team. I didn't have a success team. And our website that you'll see today, now our marketing director has taken over, but I built our website. Every single page that you saw up until, you know, 6 months ago was still basically built all by me. I onboarded every single one of our customers. I was managing every single new conversation that came on. I was also managing our finances and trying to raise. I was also starting to recruit people. I mean, there was just so much to do. And like you said, it's a competitive environment. And so you're always kind of playing bigger than you are in order to get access to those bigger customers. And fortunately, they trusted us and we've been able to deliver value to them. But with that comes a lot of pressure. Like, wait, are we ready to have this 2,000 user deal go live? Like, infrastructurally, are we ready? You know? And so with every new deal, like with every big win comes a million, you know, just stressors, right?
Expectations.
And as a CEO, exactly. And as a CEO, you know, what I always explain is just the sheer volume of decisions and context switching. Like right now I'm on 17 Zoom calls back to back per day on average.
Ouch.
Right. And half of those are with sales, marketing, success, customers, partners, you know, tax consultants, because I need to make sure that we're following our taxes, that we're booking our things correctly. And so the amount of context switching and the amount of like pieces of information that I need to be able to consume and digest and, you know, compartmentalize when that's appropriate or process when I need to, you know, like I remember one day vividly, we had been working on this deal for 3 months and this was like right before I hired a sales team and it was going to be a really great logo. Phenomenal use case, and we're competing against a really large competitor in the digital adoption space. But I was really confident that we were going to win. And I remember right before I had just come off of a huge demo with 15 employees at a different company that's also a big deal, felt great. And then I look at my email for 2 seconds and I get the email that we'd lost that deal. And I just remember like my heart sunk. But 1 minute later, I had to get on another call with another customer and be all energized and all happy and everything. And so then, you know, I went to that next call and I brought some of that negative energy with me. And then, you know, I took my email again and this other existing customer was asking us to increase their user licenses by triple what they already had, you know? And so it's just like within that 2-hour period, I went from like super high to super low to super high. You know, it's just it's just constantly learning to balance those emotions. And if you don't make space for your mind, if you don't make space to work out, take time off, see your family, see your friends, all of a sudden you don't have an outlet for all those emotions. And I think, you know, last fall, I frankly went through a pretty hard time, not because the company wasn't going well, but because I was just starting to, you know, I wasn't processing that information well enough.
Yeah, I think people underestimate. People just think that, oh, it's just high, and it's a simple ride. But we are humans, and, you know, we are not machines, and it takes toll, and we have emotions. It's not just a deal lost. I mean, sure, it's a deal lost, and it's lost revenue, but you put all the effort and the energy into it. It's not just the lost money, but the energy that you spent on it, you know. You are on a very good path, and it's their loss. I mean, they didn't join you, but yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you pretty much answered a bunch of questions, and I will come back to the mindfulness because I think that's where we should also spend a little more time. But what have been your top three challenges, if you can quickly tell us, and how did you overcome them, of running a Salesforce enterprise? Like, what do you, if there are any specific challenges of running a Salesforce enterprise?
So I think the number one is figuring out who to sell to. Right? Because depending on the organization, Salesforce is sometimes owned by sales operations, sometimes it's owned by IT, sometimes it's owned by Salesforce CRM teams. And so it's figuring out, like, ultimately who is the final decision maker. In some organizations, admins are able to make decisions on their own. Sometimes they're responsible just for setting user profiles, right? And so I think one of the challenges that we found early on was just really kind of learning how to dance with our champions, right? We've got these strong advocates and help empower these, you know, in our cases, admins, be able to sell internally, like, the bigger vision of how this is going to help with the overall change management and digital transformation they were going through, and figuring out, you know, who to include in the conversation, make sure that we had all the right parties. And so I'd say that was probably the biggest challenge for us first. Second was really uncovering, like, the pain that we really were trying to solve for. And that's an ongoing process. Both of those are ongoing processes, but really understanding, like, how do you really uncover the pain that people are, you know, willing to pay for, and not just be like, oh, this is a really cool tool. This would be a really great tool to have, because frankly, that's the reaction we get on every single demo, but not every single demo leads to a close. And the reason is that we don't actually do a good enough job of really understanding, like, what is the business value that's going to be, that they're going to be able to achieve by solving for this problem, right? Is it going to be that their admin has more time to actually build the kind of automation in Salesforce that actually drives more of their revenue? So if we're able to solve and minimize support questions, their admins and their development team can accelerate their product roadmap. Or is it that their sales teams are entering the wrong information because they're unclear on the process, and so the sales leaders and sales operations leaders don't have the right forecasting, and so that's a problem for the executive leadership and the board, right? Like, what is the underlying problem that's big enough for that individual customer to make them want to change? And how do we then tie back the value of our product to that? And that's been an ongoing process of really uncovering that pain. And then number three, I'd just say prioritization and focus, right? Like, there's a ton of different opportunities. I mean, there's what, 30 different dreaming events, there's 30 right. different world tours and dream
forces. Well, not this year.
Yeah, not this year, unfortunately. But you know, there's a lot of different kinds of customers, big, small, different industries. I mean, there's so many different ways to go to market and to see that success. But ultimately, like, the more focus you have, the more you're able to build repeatability and efficiency in your own processes. And so, you know, you don't need to sell 10,000 licenses on day one, but you do need to find the right customers that allow you to get to that 10,000 number in a repeatable and efficient way, so that you can, you know, forecast what your revenue is going to look like, and not say, like, oh, well, this month we've got, you know, 30 deals in the pipeline. Next month we've got 100. How many of those are actually going to close, right? And being able to focus your energy from a product standpoint and go to market standpoint is also a constant objective.
Hello, listeners. So as you might know, I have been working on the Salesforce freelance course, and I just wanted to give you an update. Basically, I took some time off in August, September to have some downtime and enjoy the summer, and now I'm back at it. So if you haven't filled out the survey already, it's at forcepreneur.com/freelance. I am in the final phases of finalizing and then shooting the course, and hopefully it should be ready by next month. No promises, safe harbor, but I'm working hard on it. Thank you for your support, and now enjoy the show. So with all this information that you get, and as a startup, I mean, you have right now, I'm pretty sure your product, you know, forecast would look like, oh, we can do this and this and this. How do you cancel those noise and focus? How do you decide this is what I want to pick? This is noise I don't want to, because I'm pretty sure right now your email would be bing, 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 you know, every second. And how do you
from
do
a roadmap
that?
Standpoint?
Yeah, from the roadmap and like which deals to choose, because as you said, you know, like when I was playing snooker, somebody said not, you know, snooker or pool, not every shot is pot shot. Sometimes you just have to play. So
get
how
the
do
ball
you?
The, yeah.
Yeah, right. So how do you do?
You know, that's actually, I can speak recently. We had like a big aha moment around this where, you know, we had all these different things on our roadmap that we put and we'd presented them to the board, and Zari calls me and she's like, you know, I'm just like, I'm not feeling motivated. Like, I just feel like I cannot deliver on these commitments, you know, and I don't, you know, and I'm like, well, what do you mean? Like, you know, and my vision has always been like, shoot for the moon, fall in the stars sort of thing, right? Because falling in the stars, nice, is still a great outcome.
Yeah.
But for Zari's personality, and we're quite different, you know, from that standpoint, she's only going to be focusing on the 20% that we didn't achieve, not the 80% that we did. And
okay,
that was enough to kind of make her feel like this was an insurmountable feat. And so what we ended up doing is literally wiping our roadmap clean and just putting the three things, one per quarter for the next three quarters that we are committed to doing. And now every single person in the company, whether that's product, engineering, marketing, operation success, everyone is aligned around us delivering these three really core, really differentiated, phenomenal features over the next three quarters. And we're not adding every single little, you know, UI, UX improvement. I mean, there's my list of my own in product improvements. I use spec it every day. I come up with improvements every single day, new use cases, right? Like our own internal list, our backlog is 200 tickets long, right? But it's just a matter of really thinking about, like, sometimes you need to prioritize for new customers, right? Sometimes you need to prioritize for your existing customers. And in our case, we've got the content creators, but we've also got the end users, right? And so it's content like, We have our own internal ranking system around, you know, does this drive revenue? Does this drive adoption? We kind of have key categories that we look at in order to help us determine what features are ultimately going to help us, advance the most, and also do proper scoping around them. That's something that we weren't doing previously, where we were like, oh, this seems like an easy feature. And then, you know, when it goes into the roadmap, it's like, wait, why did this end up taking 2 weeks off our roadmap? It's like, oh, well, we didn't scope it properly, et cetera. So now before anything goes on our roadmap, it's fully scoped so that we can actually reasonably predict that we'll be able to deliver it in the time that we've committed.
Interesting. And what about deals? Like, these are the features. What about deals? Like, there are some deals that you don't want to chase, right? Like, some deals, you know, the customer is just flirting with you. Let's call it like that.
Yeah. I think a lot of that comes down to discovery and really getting them to help you articulate like the financial value of bringing in a solution like ours. I think that's one piece of it, but then also, seeing how quickly they're willing to advocate to bring the decision makers in the room, right? Are they willing to tell you about how they evaluate process and all the different hoops and bounds they're going to go through, and really build the business case internally? So that's something that upfront in the discovery process, you know, especially, and this is more so for larger deals, right? So 100 users and up, that we're really doing that kind of extensive process. A lot of our SMB, smaller customers, you know, that are using us as a company-wide knowledge base, they are able to move forward pretty quickly in the sales cycle. But an example of what you just brought up is, you know, early on when we didn't have the pipeline that we have today, we were asked to build an on-prem solution for a financial institution. And at first,
what?
I was like, yeah. And at first, young CEO, young salesperson here, I was like, well, how complex is that really? Like, why wouldn't we do that if we can get like a $100,000 deal? And like, we went through it, and like, luckily we have phenomenal advisors. We had Shauna Wolverton, actually. She was also ex-Salesforce. She's a big mind behind Lightning. She's now a CPO or head of product at Zendesk. And she's like, no, you don't even go down that route. I was like, really? You know, so like in the early days, it was just like, you're kind of like holding on to any sort of hope that'll help you get the product. But now we're really thinking, and what I communicate to the sales team constantly, and the sales team is really aligned here, is just like, we see deals where, you know, it's a 3-month sales cycle process because it's for a 500 user deal, but we know exactly the steps that it takes. And they're there's the right use case. You know, we're not fighting like, oh, well, do you guys have Firefox or Safari extensions? Like, no, we have Chrome, right? So it's like, do they have Chrome? Do they have people to own the solution? Because again, that's something that we learned early on. Even if you have that one admin that's excited about the solution, if you don't have buy-in from a broader group of individuals that are bought into using this as their source of truth, you don't get used, right? So it's really all about qualifying the deal to say like, okay, does it meet our criteria? And if it doesn't, why do we think that it's worth our time to proceed, right? What is the likelihood of us actually closing? And just prioritizing that way.
Nice. So slowly we are coming to the end. And before we finish, Salesforce has this nice thing called Ohana. It's kind of a community that I've not seen in any other technology. And as you did some name drops over there, you seem to be pretty much in the network. You're also presenting Dreaming events. You started actually at a Dreaming event. So you're kind of the birth child of a Dreaming event. And that's fabulous. So what to budding entrepreneurs, what value does Ohana bring? Is it important? How it is important to you? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think as an entrepreneur, like, you've skipped a lot of steps by having like a community of avid, passionate learners and community members that are willing to give you feedback, you know. And that's what I love the most is, you know, in our early days when we were still trying to figure out, you know, what direction to go and how to call our features and what functionality to build. Like, you know, I'd met a lot of folks at the Dreamin' events, and I'd follow up with them after. It's like, hey, can I give you a tour of the product? Like, no pressure, not looking for you to buy. Like, I'd love to just get your real perspective. And, you know, reaching out to the MVP community was really fruitful there. And like, what I love the most is everyone was so willing to support a young organization that was looking to solve a major challenge that every admin of Salesforce faces. And so, you know, for us, like, the support from day one has been there. And, you know, beyond just like the actual like tangible benefits from like a product and eventually, you know, getting some of these honest customers, it was also like hugely helpful psychologically, right? Like, you know, Zari and I are just like, are you crazy for doing it? Yeah, absolutely. Affirmation and like support, like people still text me like, just saw that, you know, new feature, like, congrats, so proud of your journey, right? And like, just knowing that we have this, you know, broader support group that while I might not talk to them every day, I know that there's that group of allies behind us is really rewarding.
Nice. And you are in Denver, right? But you still have good connections to San Francisco. Are you planning to move back, or are you going to stay here now? Salesforce just opened an office there, right?
Yeah. The sign went up last week. So we decided to build our sales and success and customer facing orgs in Denver because it's a lot more cost effective than it is in San Francisco. And I have personal reasons as well. My family's out here and I love the weather. So we're building out our go-to-market teams here, but we have our design team, our product team in San Francisco. So my co-founder, we're actually remote co-founders because she's actually in San Francisco. And so we've got our designer and we've got one of our SDRs out there. And then our development team is actually in Pakistan. That's where Zari is originally from. And so her good friend is our director of engineering there. And so we have a phenomenal team of engineers out there too. So we're a pretty dispersed team, and we've got a couple employees remote as well across the United States.
Interesting. So you might be the first one where I'm seeing. So I like, you have a development team in Pakistan. So I, through Forspreneur, I'm also trying to interview some people in Pakistan, so that, because, you know, it's a country. I am from India and I want to go to Pakistan because my grandpa was from there, but we cannot go there because of whatever reasons and this politics and all that bullshit. I'm saying it. It's just making this. And I want to bring out, because a lot of people are earning their livelihood through Upwork and all these websites. You know, if you go there, there are a lot of people and their situation is much worse than India. So kudos to you. I'll again put an applause over there for you guys for, you know, helping that economy, like getting people jobs over there, because that place is much more effed than any place else, you know. And I have had some Pakistani people over here, and for them, life is really hard because they're like, you can very proudly go and say, hey, I'm from India. And people are like, yeah, which curry, you know? And we just say we are from Pakistan, and people are like, oh, okay. You know, like that's, wow. that's kind of, at least in Europe.
That's so sad to hear too, because I had the privilege of going to Pakistan to meet the team November 2018. And I mean, I've yet to meet a team of more, and they have gone above and beyond since day one, but committed, funny, smart, you know, passionate individuals. I mean, you know, obviously most of our communication is done via Slack, but we also do, you know, we have a Monday morning meeting with all three of our teams, because it's really important that everyone feel as part of the connection, right? So we really don't think of them as like, oh, we're outsourcing development to this company. Like, no, these are our employees. They share all the same values as us, right? They're part of the same standups. They're part of the same team communications. Like, this is our team. They just happen to be located in Pakistan. And, you know, to your point, you know, in those countries, like a lot of them, young individuals are supporting their entire families with their compensation. And so, you know, you get a lot of commitment there too, but that's something that Zari and I talk about quite a bit, which is like, you know, as we think about, you know, what the bigger purpose and mission of, you know, our journey with Speckit, you know, kind of going back to the diversity scholarship, like what are some initiatives that we could lead in Pakistan in particular to provide more opportunities for women there in the engineering space. Right. So it's something that it's top of mind. We're kind of being intentional from a focus standpoint of really taking on what we can, but I think there's a really great opportunity to encourage and bring more visibility to the incredible pool of talent that you can find there.
Incredible. Hats off to you. So in your journey until now, what would be your advice to budding forcepreneurs, people who want to start a business or are into this? And also mindfulness part, I think that's also important. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, talking to as many entrepreneurs kind of like you're doing right now, to hear their journeys and really like ask them like the hard questions, right? The ones like, okay, how often have you wanted to give up, right? Like, how do you manage the day-to-day stress? Like, you know, how did you actually do the research up front for your idea? Like really understanding like the key steps that were taken to get to the point where they were ready to launch. Because for us, like I did a year of actually like research and designing the solution before we even like did a line of code, right? Because I was evaluating.
Did you have a full-time job during
this
time?
But the funny thing is because I was leading business operations, my goal was to like, Speckit was born out of the fact that I was looking for a solution. So nice. I evaluated over 100 solutions between knowledge bases, LMSs, digital adoption, et cetera, to try and solve for our internal problem. And then it was after doing all of that I was able to identify the gaps. I started attending conferences with other BizOps leaders to understand like, well, how are you guys dealing with this problem in Salesforce? And everyone was just like, ugh, it was like an eye roll, right? Like, yeah, change is hard. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, everyone's rolling their eyes and frustrated by the problem. There's a lot of solutions out there, but they don't solve it the way that I envision it, right? And then I did surveys of admins and end users and then presented those to Zari. And she's like, well, let's do, you know, more extensive surveys. And so we did a lot of research before we did that. And I think that added some protective layers because frankly, if you would have seen I still have my original designs of Speckit and they're quite a different set of features and functionality than you see today. And so I think it's really important to really invest the time in the research, you know, initially part-time to do that. And then only when you're really ready, like, okay, I need to do this full-time, do you take that leap? And two, finding a co-founder, super, super important. And then three, yes, like figuring out like, what is it that your soul, what is it that you are going to need as a human in order to manage and balance and grow on this journey? Because it's going to be incredibly hard. It's going to take way longer than you think. You're going to want to give up a lot of times. And so, you know, realizing that you're your own MVP, like you are your most valuable player. And so how can, you know, you prioritize sleep and the things that really matter because it allows you to show up with kind of energy where like 7 hours of my best energy is better than 20 hours of me operating at 70%. That 30% difference there makes a huge, huge impact in my clarity of thought and my ability to prioritize and make the right decisions.
Perfect. I think that's advice is piece of gold. Any entrepreneurs that you look up to apart from Mark and how's the Apple guy, Ankit?
Steve Jobs?
Yeah. Because these two are the most common answers. I mean, if they are, that's fair. But do you look up to anyone, especially female entrepreneurs?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously they're phenomenal in many ways, largely because of the bigger impact that they're having beyond just building great technology. You know, I've really been seeking out female entrepreneurs that I admire. One that I recently listened to a podcast about is Sarah Blakely. She's the founder of Spanx. So not technology, but Spanx, it's like the compressor underwear thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
and she built that business from scratch to over $1 billion in revenue. And she, you know, from a value standpoint is very much aligned. So listening to her and hearing her speak, she had four kids in the process. I mean, it's just phenomenal. And so she's someone that has recently come on my radar as someone that I want to really, you know, hopefully get the chance to know sometime.
Any book a budding entrepreneur should read? Do you read? You like to read?
I want to say that I read because every entrepreneur reads. I have a hard time making it through books. I mean, I buy books, but then like I kind of speed read and then I get bored after four chapters. I need to start reading fiction like Harry Potter I love, but I've tried reading every business book ever recommended to me and I just kind of skip through it. I listen to audiobooks more. Those I can get through, and I listen to a mix of like personal development as well as business ones. Right now I'm reading, it's a book by James Quick, and it's called Limitless, and it's about how to trick your mind to learn faster. So that one's quite good. I listened to him on a podcast. I actually listen to a lot more podcasts than I read books, because I think you're able to get, you know, the 90% of what they probably cover in their book anyway, just in an hour-long session. So, and The School of Greatness is the podcast that I would recommend in that case.
Okay, fair enough. Last, what's your favorite productivity habit?
Two things. One, I am constantly reorganizing my to-do list by kind of team or priority level. And so I'm pretty religious about that. And then B, actually blocking out like hours where I can just focus on one task. And so that's unfortunately something that I don't get done during the day because I really have that time. But when I go home, I'll sometimes have dinner. I'm like, you know what, tonight I'm going to spend 2 hours where I've got no phone, no computer, no distractions. And I'm just working on solving for our messaging or working on something. And it's funny because that might not sound like a productivity hack, but it is, because otherwise I would break it down over every 30 minutes that I find and I never get anywhere. Sometimes you just need to like sit down and get the job done and give yourself the space for your mind to actually get in the flow.
Thank you, Melanie. That was really, really fun. I think, people can really learn from your story and you're on a really good path. Before we finish, I have a quick rapid fire round. I don't know if you know about this. So I'm just going to quickly ask you some questions, which is like this or that. And I'm sure you will be fabulous on it.
All right.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Windows or Mac?
Mac.
Ebooks or hard copy?
Hard copy.
Are you a morning person or a night person?
That one's hard because I was always a morning person. Now I'm starting to realize that I get my best work done at night and that I have a hard time waking up. So I've become a night owl when I was a morning one for a long time.
What's your choice of the calming routine? Meditation, yoga, jogging, working out, journaling?
Journaling.
Okay. If you could beam yourself to one place, where would it be?
Bahamas.
If you had a time machine, would you like to travel in the past or in the future?
Pass.
Your favorite trailblazer mascot?
Astra.
Okay. Which city do you like to travel to for business?
San Francisco.
As a business traveler, which hotel chain is the best value for money?
I always do Airbnb almost all the time. But yeah, I do Airbnb. I can't even tell you.
Okay. What's the most crazy thing that you have seen in an org?
Oh, boy. Users logging into two different orgs to do two different business processes.
Ouch. What's the best thing you have seen in an org?
You know, one of our newer customers, they're about to roll it out for the first time to 1,800 users, their financial institution, and I have yet to see a team that is so progressive, and they're in a financial industry, so they're in the laggard industry. They are just following every guideline, every step in the process. They are so committed. They've got a change management agent. They've got a learning development team on it. And I am very confident in their success. So I think it's more so just the amount of planning and thought that went into their social org and the commitment that they've made to make it a success.
Nice. Best Dreamforce and why?
Wow. It was actually last year. 2018, I've only been to 2018 and 2019. Our first time at Dreamforce was as a booth. But last year I got to be in the executive track, which was just a really, really, which was a big privilege. And so I got to see like a live rendition of Hamilton. I got to see Steve Jobs talk. So I think it's pretty hard, not Steve Jobs, Tim Cook talk. So I think it's hard to beat that.
Okay. Last question. Can Google be dethroned?
No.
All right. Fair enough.
Maybe in the workplace. That's second.
Okay. Cheers.
Yeah. We actually talk about visualizing your workplace.
Nice. Thank you, Melanie. That was your time. It was really fun talking to you. Do you have any closing notes?
No. Thank you so much for inviting me. This is fun. And, you know, if you're listening to this and you're an entrepreneur and you're looking for, you know, guidance or next steps, feel free to reach out to me. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. And, you know, as time permits, always happy to help.
Right. Thank you. Thank you so much.